John chapter 4, and as we're doing that, if you are 3 years old through the third grade and would like to go to our junior church, you can make your way out the doors, and our workers will take you from there, and then they'll bring you back up after the service. Normally, when we have a special holiday, we would take the time to do something that would be more geared toward that particular holiday. And so, you take advantage of those. And there are a number of things that we could talk about as far as our country is concerned. And we've spent some time the last two Wednesday nights talking about Christian and politics, or how we should be involved. Have had a great discussion on that. And so that's been a fun thing for us. But I'm going to press on this morning, really for two reasons. One, because I just prayed about it and felt like this was the best direction for us to take. And secondly, because I'm going to preach this morning and I'll preach next Sunday morning, and there's a little break in what we're studying at that point, and that's a good time for it. I'm going to have knee surgery the following day on the 11th. And so you'll get to hear Pastor Stewart for at least 2 weeks, and we'll see how it goes after that. But I'll have both knees replaced, so I should be able to run up and down the aisles, and maybe if I recover completely, run on top of the pews all the way back through there. But that, we're not exactly sure how long that recovery will be, but it will be a little bit gradual as we do that, and so we'll see how many services I'll be able to do on a Sunday, even when I do get to the place where I'm a little more recovered. I tell you what, I love the morning services, but we've had such a good time in our Sunday school class this morning. Most of my group's on vacation, I think, but we've had a ball with that. And I sit on a stool there anyway a lot of times, so that may be the one that I'll get to do first, is come back and study in the book of Revelation. So I'll be here this Sunday and next Sunday, and many of you have asked even today about when that is. So that's the 11th. I've been cleared of all my medical tests, and they've poked and prodded and experimented on me and everything else, so I'm ready to go with it. And Christy's going to give me a piggyback ride home, so we're ready to roll. We've been looking at 2 Corinthians since the beginning of the year, and it is with the objective of understanding that a Christian needs to have an eternal perspective rather than a temporal perspective, that we need to be thinking long-term, not just building houses here and collecting things, but deciphering what is it that we're going to take with us into eternity. And when you study the passage beginning in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16, and through chapter 5, he then comes to the place where he says, you understand that the eternal is what's important, not just the temporal, but you have a position as an ambassador for Christ. You are a representative here on this earth. And we've been looking at this idea of the ambassadorship. And the ambassadorship that we have is something that God takes very seriously. And unfortunately, what we discover is many times people administrate their ambassadorship haphazardly. It's as though an ambassador has been appointed to a country and he says, "Oh, I'm going to go to China and be an ambassador," and they make no plans and they make no preparations for that. They just go to China and say, "Oh, well, we're going to see what comes out of this." And that's how many Christians administrate their ambassadorship. They don't really make any plans. They don't think, "How am I going to be a good ambassador? How am I going to make this effective? How can I be effective for God?" And so we spent some time looking at that. How am I going to be a good ambassador for Christ? And one of the ways that we do that is we look at Scripture and we have Jesus as the ideal ambassador for the God of heaven. And last week we looked at his interaction with Nicodemus. The fact that Jesus interacts with real people. Nicodemus was real. The Samaritan woman is real. And these real people are people that can help us understand how Jesus Christ himself interacted and how he accomplished the things that God wanted him to do. And Jesus had a plan, and he had resources. And you and I need to have a plan. We need to understand the resources that are available. We've talked often about the exchange program that's available for you. And I want you to learn that there ought to be a culture of evangelism and discipleship. So often we've gotten the idea that we witness on a certain night of the week, or we witness at a specific time. No, our life as an ambassador means that we're representing God. So when we come to this passage, when we come to John chapter 4, we have Jesus interacting with the lady we just know as the Samaritan woman. We're never given her name. We don't know anything beyond this encounter about her. We just know that Jesus had this encounter. But I want you to think of this more than just an exposition of this passage. I want you to think of it in light of Jesus as the example of an ambassador, and very specifically how God takes occasions and He puts us in a place where where He wants us to accomplish something. You know, I always think about when I went to college and I went to Bob Jones, Christy went to Bob Jones, Mike and Sherry did, several people in here would know about this, but now when you go there, when you go to eat, there is a beautiful cafeteria. I mean, you go in and they've got the sandwich station and the salad station, and they have chocolate milk, and they have Coke, and they have Coke, and they have chocolate milk. I think there's regular milk too, but I only see the chocolate milk. And they have pizza stations, and I mean, they've got food all the way down through, and you can go choose. You know, Joy was totally spoiled when she was there. But when we went to school, you had divine appointments. You would get this little thing in the mail that says, for dinner, and everybody had to go to dinner. The people who are older than I will say, only dinner. We had to go to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But we had to go to the evening meal at 6 o'clock. It was required that you be there unless you had some approved excuse to be gone from dinner. And you went to the dinner table, and I forget exactly how many were at each full table, but you had kind of half tables here. And there were, I'm going to say there were 15 to 18 there. I don't know, 12 maybe. But there was a table, and you would sit here, and you got this thing in the mail that said, you're seated at table 11D. And so every 6 or 7 weeks, you'd get a new one in your mailbox, and you would switch the people at your table. Well, when you went to that table, you never knew for sure who you were going to be sitting with. And so you had divine appointments. And some of the men and ladies that were there were always looking forward to that switch, because you never knew when you sat at that table if you might meet the person who was going to be your spouse. It was kind of a forced dating situation. You're going to sit with this group for 6 weeks and get to know them, and then we're going to switch, and we're going to mix all of these people up and see if we can get everybody together. And it was great. It was fun because it forced you to meet a lot of new people. They were divine appointments. They were orchestrated by the office, but it was something that was orchestrated for you. I have to tell you that every time I go sit on an airplane, it goes through my mind, who is the person who's going to be sitting beside me? Now, I think selfishly at a lot of times because, you know, the seats are small, and I think I hope nobody's beside me, but it always goes through my mind when somebody sits down beside me, this is somebody God put beside me for a specific reason. God put them here for me to talk to them. Now, it's so much harder to talk to people now because as soon as you sit down on an airplane, people put earbuds in. And it's very difficult to talk to people for the most part. But I always think that's a divine appointment. That's somebody that God put there so that I could talk to them. And like being an assigned a table, God orchestrated that. And when you read this story, you realize that Jesus Christ was under the leadership of His Heavenly Father, and that His Heavenly Father was orchestrating a meeting for Him. And for you and I, many people do not see our casual interactions as divine appointments. We don't see that as we go through our daily activities, that these casual things that we do, whether it's a server at a restaurant, or whether it's a person at work, or whether it's somebody that shows up at your house, that perhaps these casual interactions are actually divine appointments. That God has put you there for a very specific reason. And when you study this story, you begin to realize that just like God was orchestrating in Jesus Christ's life a time to interact with this Samaritan woman, He's also orchestrating these things in your life. And so I'm going to put it out here as this statement that's up on the screen behind me. The premise would be this, that God ordains your path to orchestrate your opportunities. Many times people will say, well, how am I going to witness to somebody? Well, you know, you can come on a certain night of the week. We've had a Tuesday night where people would go and interact with people. But for the most part, I don't want people to simply get in the mindset of Tuesday night is when we go soul winning. Because the Bible doesn't teach that. The Bible teaches that God ordains your path to orchestrate your opportunities. Here are your opportunities to interact with people in a way that you'll not be able to interact with people normally. Go back to this passage for just a moment. Let's read beginning in verse 1 again. And I'll point out a couple of things to set the stage here. When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made or was making more and baptizing more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again unto Galilee. Now, if you have an idea in your mind of Judea and Galilee, then you know that that's a straight shot north. There was a group we just got back from Israel and Jordan, and if you would imagine Jerusalem right here, you go from Jerusalem straight north, and Galilee is kind of off to the right just a little bit. So Galilee is in that area right up there. Okay? So, now, read on, because this is important. It says in verse 4, and he must needs, or it is, he had to pass through Samaria. Then cometh he to the city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on or by the well, and it was about the sixth hour. Now, Jesus took the straight path from Jerusalem to Galilee. And so he headed north, and on the way north, about halfway, is Sychar. And that's where Jacob's well was. There's still a place called Jacob's well. They don't know if it's exactly the same spot, but we think it might be. But halfway up there is Jacob's well. Now, here's the thing that you need to know about the story. Jews didn't take that path. Straight north of Judea was the area called Samaria. And the Samaritans were considered half-breeds. They didn't worship God. They had syncretism. They had amalgamated other gods into their worship. And the Samaritans and the Jews did not get along with each other. The Jews considered every Samaritan woman unclean. Completely unclean. They wouldn't drink after them. They wouldn't talk to them. They had no interactions. As much as possible, they would not go into Samaria. They wouldn't deal with the Samaritan people. They tried to just completely ignore them. And so what they would do, and again, you kind of got to get this in your mind, and some of you who were there recently will get this and you'll understand, they would leave Jerusalem, and instead of going like this, straight up to Galilee, they would go like this, over here, up, and back over. Now, for those of you who were there, you'd know that you go this way, you have to cross the Jordan River, go over here into what is now Jordan, go north, cross the Jordan River again, and you're in Galilee. That's a lot of work. And these people were willing to go through all of that in order to not to go through Samaria. And so when you get to this passage and it says, he must needs, or he had to pass through Samaria, you get the idea that Jesus had an objective for going through there. He sensed that God wanted him to take that path for a very specific reason. And I'm sure there was some resistance or maybe some question from his disciples. Lord, do you really want to go through this way? You know, it's kind of dangerous and we don't really like these people. We could go the other way and it would be a lot nicer. Sure, it takes longer, but we wouldn't have to deal with these Samaritan people. But here is God ordaining his path to orchestrate his opportunities. And when you get to verse 7, you see the opportunities he has. And I want you to think today about what happened with Jesus Christ and what happens often with us as God orchestrates our path and he provides opportunities for us. Because we end up interacting with people and with in ways that we never expected to do. Let me give you one that people end up with opportunities. Opportunities with people that we don't normally interact with. When you get to verse 7, it says, there comes this woman from Samaria to get water out of the well. And we could study more about her. She's coming at an unusual time of the day. It says that it was the sixth hour. If you go by Roman time, that's 6 p.m. If you go by Jewish time, that's noon. Either one will work. I kind of lean towards 6 p.m. I think it was toward the end of the day, but noon would well work either. You could make an argument for both, and either one works. So you can argue for either, but let's say that it was 6 o'clock in the evening, and she comes, and she's drawing water. And he looks over, and he says, give me to drink. Now, here are people that the Jews don't normally interact with. The normal prejudices prohibited public conversation, especially between a man and a woman. They didn't do that a whole lot anyway. This is something that I have to think about when I travel over in the Middle East. It is unusual. It's not prohibited, but it's not, you know, if I'm talking to people here in the United States, I talk to men, I talk to ladies, I talk to children, I talk to animals. I talk to anybody. But you have to be a little more reserved when you're over there. Because it's not like it is here where you can just talk to anybody. Even now, there's a little bit of a reservation that you have to have. But there are the normal prejudices. Number one, men didn't talk to women very much. Then the Jews did not interact with the Samaritans, especially with strangers. And so you've got these prejudices that are there and people that you don't normally interact with. It is said that a Jewish rabbi would rather go thirsty than to violate these proprietary rules that were given. He would rather go thirsty. He wouldn't drink the water that the woman gave him. It would be considered unclean. And so he just wouldn't do it. But here's Jesus interacting with people that he doesn't normally interact with. Now, that's going to happen to you. And when you interact with people that you don't normally interact with, sometimes their first thought is, man, I got to get out of here. I don't want to talk to these people. I don't want to be with them. You know, for me, it's not this way because I love my family members on both sides. But there are some who go to their family reunions and think, man, I want to get out of here. That's a tough place to be in. But these are people that you don't normally react with. Here, let me give you a second opportunity that the Lord may give you. Opportunities with people who have a smidgen of knowledge. Now, that word smidgen in Hebrew, that means a little bit. In Greek, it means enough to be dangerous. In Aramaic, it means I don't remember. But I went with that word intentionally. It's not that she just had a little bit of knowledge. It's a smidgen of knowledge, but she's convinced she knows enough. And when you read this passage, here is somebody who has just a little bit of knowledge about spiritual things. And when you read in verses 11 through 14, look at some of the things that she knows. In verse 11, the woman said to him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From where are you going to get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? Hey, she knows about Jacob. She knows a little bit about the Old Testament, and we're at Jacob's well, and she knows that Jacob dug this well, and Jacob is a great man. When you come down to verses 16 through 26, she's actually going to change the subject from what Jesus wants to talk about. And in verses 16 through 26, in verse 19, she says, sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. And ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where we ought to worship. Well, here she is again. She's saying, I've got some spiritual knowledge. You don't have anything on me. I know some spiritual truth. I know some things. And so she asked him, are you greater than our father Jacob? And the way that it's written in its construction is it expects a negative answer that Jesus would go, oh, no, I'm not greater than Jacob. But Jesus doesn't say that. And that piques her interest. And she's surprised by his answer. When you go to verse 11, Jesus in verse 13 says, answered and said unto her, whoever, everyone who drinks of the water, this water shall thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall become in him a well springing up to or into everlasting life. Now, as she's listening to this, you and I don't get it as clearly, but there are three questions that immediately come up. Bang, number one, who is this guy? And who am I talking to here? I've asked her, you think you're greater than Jacob? And he doesn't answer that question. Who is this? And then there's another question. What's the gift of God? He said, if you understood the gift of God that he gives you. Well, what gift? I don't see any gift. And then there's a third question. What's the living water? What are you talking about? Here's a person who has a smidgen of knowledge. Did you ever talk to somebody like that? They have just enough knowledge to be dangerous. I love the ones who say, you know, I'd talk about the Bible, but man, the Bible's full of errors. Do you know what your answer should be to that? And I've told you this before, but it'll work in 99% and maybe more of that. Show me one, would you? Well, I don't really know where they are. They're in there. Well, you know, I've got a Bible. I've got one here on my phone. Let's talk about those errors. Which error are you talking about? They have a smidgen of knowledge. They have something that's probably a contradiction that they think is an error, something that they don't understand. And there will be people who say, well, you know, God loves everyone. Well, you have a smidgen of knowledge. But do you know God is also just and he will mete out punishment? You know that God also calls himself just? And so when you go up to somebody and you ask, so how would you describe your relationship with God? That's how the exchange starts, by the way. How would you describe your relationship with God? That opens the door. But here's a person who has a smidgen of knowledge. But don't ever let that dissuade you. This person may have a little bit of knowledge, but she obviously doesn't know who Jesus Christ is, and she obviously doesn't have much depth. And so here's an opportunity, not only with a person that we don't normally interact with, but a person that has a smidgen of knowledge. Look at the third thing here in verse 15. Opportunities with people who are selfish. I kind of struggled on how to put this, because you don't normally think of the Samaritan woman as selfish, and I don't mean this totally negatively, because I think this is normal. Look at verse 15. He said, I'm going to give you an opportunity to have some living water, water that springs up to everlasting life. And in verse 15, the woman says to him, Sir, give me this water that I thirst not, neither come hither or come all this way up here to draw water. You know what she's thinking? That he's talking about a well that would never end. Physical water. And it's kind of this idea. You know, this week the mega lottery, what's the big one called? Super lottery, whatever it is. But I heard it on the radio. I had to go down, you know, to meet somebody, and I was on the radio. And this week it was up to some astronomical number again, 280, 300 million or something like that. And I didn't win. You know, I've never played the lottery, and you know, invest your money much more wisely than that. But here's this lottery, and it's up to these hundreds of millions of dollars, and there are dozens of people thinking, man, if I could just win that, I would never have to work again. My life would be great. I could do whatever I want, whenever I want. That is what I need in my life. This lady understands the monotony of life. Every day, she has to carve out some time to walk up that mountain, to go to that well, draw the water out, put it on, put it back on her head, go back to the house. And the next day, get up and do it all again. There are certain things that are just monotonous. You know, sometimes I'm very envious of some of the Jewish people. I'm kind of envious of the guys on Duck Dynasty. I get in the shower every morning and I have a mirror in there and I look at that razor. I think, I got to shave again today. And the next morning, I got to do it again. And the very fact that I have to take a shower every day, that's just monotonous. Do you know how much time we spend doing that? Please don't stop. But there's the monotony of life. Man, I got to get up and go to work and come home and go to bed and get up and do it again. Over and over and over. And this lady understood the monotony of life. She understood that it was something that was just going to go on and on and on and on. This was a person who understood that she would get thirsty, and if she had this spring of water, she would never get thirsty and would never have to draw from that well again. And oh, from a selfish perspective, how wonderful that would be. If I could win the lottery, all my problems would be solved. That's what I really need. And she doesn't understand. No, you need something way beyond that. And just like the person who, if they would win the lottery, that's not really going to solve your problems. That may create more problems than you have. And I know everybody has the answer to that. Oh, not me. You know, I'd give a tithe to the church. You know, but here's this lady who says, you know, if I had a spring just right outside my house, what life would be wonderful. But you're going to deal with selfish people. People that you have to get off of the physical, the temporal, and get them to the place where they think about spiritual things. Most people that you talk to are going to be like that. Hey, you know, don't get me off track. I'm on a track to make money. I'm on a track to do something here. Don't get me thinking about spiritual things. I need to do important things. You know, they're selfishly thinking, I have things that I want to do. Hey, there are people like that here. You're still thinking selfishly. You're not thinking eternally. And God wants you to consider other things. Here's a fourth one. Opportunities with people involved in sinful lifestyles. Many of us have read this. As you get to this place, our scripture reading stopped here, but I want you to read verses 16 through 18. After she said, you know, sir, give me this water, in verse 16, Jesus said to her, go call thy husband and come here. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, thou hast well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that saidst thou truly, or you were accurate in what you said, you were honest in what you said. Here is a lady who has been involved in a very sinful lifestyle. When Jesus asked her to go get her husband, it's not offensive, nor is it something that he's trying to dig at. You know, go get your husband here, gotcha. No, this would be normal in the culture. She was having trouble understanding, and so go get your husband and bring him, because maybe in talking to him, he can help you understand. Even in the New Testament, you know, wives are to ask their husband. There's this communication between the two. So it wasn't offensive for him to say, you know, why don't you go get your husband? That would have not struck her oddly at all. But when he said that, she had to kind of hang her head and say, I don't have a husband. And all of a sudden, here's an acknowledgement of the sinfulness of life. You know, appropriately, and I want to stress that appropriately, this is not the circle that you and I run in. This is the struggle that some of our evangelical brethren are having. They see a problem, but they're solving it incorrectly. You know, we don't interact with sinful people much, so we ought to get involved in some sin so we can interact with them. Wait a minute. Wrong way to approach it. We do need to interact with sinful people, but not in their sin. Jesus didn't go have an affair with a lady so he could witness to her. That would have been blasphemous to do that. And many times we'll hear people who call themselves Christians take that philosophy even in church. Well, if we, you know, make the music so it would draw them in. Well, listen, our music is not to please the people who are lost. It's worship to God. We want something different. And Jesus was pointing out to her, you have a sinful lifestyle, and appropriately, that's not the circle you and I run in. We don't spend our time with people who are carousing, and we shouldn't. We don't spend our time with people who are in degradation, sinful lifestyles. And that's not where we're supposed to be as believers. But at the same time, God is going to orchestrate our lives so that we have opportunities to be with people who are involved in sinful lifestyles. And you know, most of the time, I find that the people who are involved in that sinful lifestyle know that they're involved in a sinful lifestyle. Have you ever been someplace, and I've told you, you know, I have several places that I go, and I'm known as the preacher. And so I'll go to Solenberger's, you know, and the preacher's there, so, you know, they have a question, and we'll talk and things. But somebody once in a while will say, excuse my French. Well, what do they mean by that? Well, you know what they mean by that. They're going to throw out some good cuss word here, and they're going to say, excuse your French. And a lot of times I'll say, no. What? Well, I say, no, I'm not going to excuse it. Just don't do it. Throws the story way off. You know, this person recognizes, because I'm standing there, that here's language they shouldn't be using. You know, somebody will come up to you and once in a while you'll find a couple living together, and they'll find out a preacher, and they'll begin to talk, and eventually there'll be a phrase that they'll say, and it's comforting to me. You know what they say? I know we should get married. Yeah. Well, I didn't say anything. I'm just there. I know we should get married. I know we're in sin. You'll have somebody who will look at you and say, I know I should go to church. I know I should be there Wednesday night. Hey, I didn't even have to say anything. There are many times that you don't even have to say anything, and God has convicted the person. I'm glad they're convicted, and usually I'm not going to pile on. Occasionally I'll say something like, yeah, you should. But they already know it's sin. And here's this lady, and as soon as Jesus asked her this very appropriate question, and she said, you know, I don't have a husband, and he said, well, you know, I know what's going on in your life. And as Jesus, he could reveal that. He said, the truth is, the man that you're living with now, he's not your husband, is he? And I know. Wow, does he know. And I know that pornographic site you clicked on last night. Oh. And I know that affair that you're having. And I know that bad attitude that you have exhibited. And I know how you have had a gripe session with your teenage friends about the school or about your parents. And I know. You see, you think Jesus doesn't know these things, and here's Jesus in this casual conversation with a lady, and he said, the five others you've been with haven't been your husband either. Know all about it. Boy, now what's this lady going to do? She has gone from this Jewish guy asking her for a drink of water to him looking her in the eye and saying, I know what you're involved in. This guy is somebody I need to deal with. And you have an opportunity to be involved with, an opportunity with people involved in sinful lifestyles. The first thing they need is to understand who Jesus Christ is. They don't have to change their behavior to get saved. When they get saved, they'll change their behavior. I need them to understand and come to a place of repentance of their sin. But they need to be saved. And God is at times going to orchestrate your affairs so that you have opportunities with people who are involved in sinful lifestyles. Let's look at the last one. God is going to orchestrate your affairs so you have opportunities with people who need to hear the truth. You come to this last part, and this lady gets spiritual again. She changes the subject. She says, you know, let's talk about something spiritual. Let me throw out what I know here. You know, our people say we should worship in Mount Gerizim. Your people say that it should be the Temple Mount. You know, who's right here? And Jesus brings her back to the place where he says, God is a spirit, and those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not the place, it's your heart. Now, let's go back and read a little bit of this. Go to verse 19. The woman says unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and your people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus says unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour comes when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship you know not what. and you don't really know what you worship. Let's just go on. We know what we worship. For salvation is of the Jews, but the hour comes, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeks such to worship him. God is spirit. a spirit, and they that worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. The woman says unto him, I know that Messiah comes, which is called Christ. When he has come, he will declare to us all things. He'll tell us all things. Jesus said unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. Wow. Hey, something to realize in this passage. Jesus never says it that clearly when he's talking to a Judean crowd, because they would have been offended by what he was claiming, that he was claiming to be the Messiah. But here with this Samaritan, he was much more open. He said to her, Lady, I am the Messiah. And he was exposing her need of that Messiah. And he literally said to her, I am the Messiah. To the people in Judea and the people in Galilee, he wasn't going to be that clear. He wasn't going to make that self-declaration as openly. But with the Samaritans, there was no danger of a revolt like there would be with the other people. But Jesus was saying, I want you to know the truth. I want you to come to the place where you're aware that God has something for you. And the problem that people have is that just like Jesus interacted with this lady, people don't see that their casual interactions are divine appointments. And they don't understand that God ordains your path to orchestrate your opportunities. You know, I try to make a regular trip to my neighbors and just talk to them. And apparently the Lord didn't think that I had talked to the neighbors in the brown house next to me enough. I got home last night, and when I got home last night, I went out to the barn, and I have two calves out there, and those two calves, I'll go out, and you'd love this. I go out and I take their little feed bucket and I go, hey boys, and bang it on the stall. You know, and I'll see them, they'll raise their head and look around, and I'll, hey boys, and they'll come up, and I give them a little bit of grain to keep them coming to the barn. Well, last night I went out and I did that. And nobody came. Well, that's an eerie feeling if you've ever had cattle. So I got on the golf cart and thought, well, I better drive down there. They're either deaf or they're hiding. So, you know, I got on the golf cart and started riding around. And before I even got into the field where the calves were supposed to be, I looked down in front of my house, and they're down there happily grazing in the field down there. That's not my field. Nor is it theirs. And so, you know, that sinking feeling, here's another half hour, 45 minutes, I'm not going to get to eat dinner. And so I go down there, and my neighbors had already seen them. They're very pleasant. We get along great. And so these two calves are just grazing over that way, and they look at the front yard and say, man, that stuff looks good. Let's go eat a little flower over there. So we go over there, and my neighbors are out there, and finally we get them into this stall, and I'm working with them, and those things are fast, especially for a guy with bad knees. And so there's one that's a little bigger than the other, so I finally got this thing close enough that I just had to dive on him and grab him and tackle him. It looked like I was in a rodeo. My legs are flying, and so my neighbor's, you know, up there laughing, and she says, you wait till I tell people what my preacher can do. And I thought, my preacher? And so I had the opportunity to talk to them. Now they've not come to church. They're very pleasant. I enjoy them. They've never shown any interest. But you know what I look at that as? Not only is it an aggravation that my cattle got out and the deer tore my fence up and that I had to spend the time of doing that, but the fact is, God ordained my path to orchestrate my opportunities. And I got to spend about a half an hour with Karen and Joan. They even came to my house. They were in the front of the truck. I was in the back holding on to a calf. But they even came to my house. It develops relationships. And here's God saying, I'm going to let your cattle out. Now, I've made the deal. God, I'll stop and see them every 3 months if you don't tear my fence up. But here's God orchestrating my path in order to give me an opportunity. Let me ask you. When God orchestrates your path, do you see it as an opportunity? When God brings you to the place where, as His ambassador, He said, I want you to go here. Do you see that as a divine appointment? When Jesus Christ sat on that well, He, God in human flesh, knew, I've got a divine appointment here. A lady's going to come up the hill shortly and we're going to talk. You and I don't know that much, but every time I go someplace, here's a divine appointment. Here's an opportunity. Here's an opportunity to open a door and see where it goes. And as a church family, we have to begin to develop that mindset that God has titled us ambassadors. And in the way He orchestrates our life, He says, here is for you this week a divine appointment. And it might lead to you saying to somebody, you know, I've got this Bible study. Would you do it with me? And you'd be surprised how many will say, you know, I'd really like to do that. And God might bring somebody to a place of salvation because you saw it as a divine appointment. Let's bow for prayer, please.